Welcome, and thank you for joining us for another episode of KPMG's Inside International Tax, a podcast devoted to recent developments, observations, and trends related to U.S. international tax. I'm one of your hosts, Kristen Gamboa, a managing director in KPMG's WNT International Tax Practice. I'm joined by my co-host, Gary Scanlon, a principal in the same group. Hey, Gary.
Hey, Kristen. I've never been more excited to be here.
So today we're tackling a subject ripped from the headlines, tariffs. President Trump has introduced a flurry of tariffs since his inauguration, including a general 25% tariff on all imports from Canada and Mexico, and a 10% tariff on Canadian energy products, which, after a brief pause, went into effect on March 4th with a one-month exception for automakers. The administration has also tasked officials with calculating reciprocal tariffs on a country-by-country basis and is considering tariffs on countries imposing digital services taxes on American companies. In addition, Trump has announced a 25% tariff on all steel and aluminum imports and two separate 10% tariff increases on Chinese goods, while potential tariffs on cars, copper, semiconductors, and pharmaceuticals from the EU are also under consideration. This surge of executive action has brought tariffs to the forefront of tax policy and has left professionals and taxpayers searching for answers. In today's episode, we'll shed light on these developments. We'll explore how tariffs work, the extent of presidential authority in imposing them, and the practical consequences for taxpayers and businesses alike. So whether you're an industry insider or simply curious about the ripple effects of these policies, this episode is for you. For our discussion today, we're joined by Lou Abad, a principal in KPMG's WNT International Tax Practice, specializing in trade and customs, making his debut on the podcast. Welcome to the podcast, Lou.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to join you and Gary today, and I'm excited to talk tariffs.
And we're excited to hear about them. So because the news about tariffs is so fast moving, we have to tell you exactly when we're recording. We are recording at 1 p.m. on Thursday, March 6th. By 2 p.m., things may have changed. Lou, you mentioned that there is a press conference. Things are moving very fast. But let us start at the beginning. I am not a tariff expert. Tariffs aren't typically top of mind for many tax professionals. Lou, could you give us a tariffs 101 lesson? What are the basic mechanics of tariffs?
Sure, absolutely. So just to level set, tariffs are assessed on physical goods that cross borders. They're not assessed on services or digital information. We get this question all the time. It's physical goods that cross borders. And just to dispel a myth that was put out there on the campaign is that the tariffs are not paid by foreign countries. They're actually paid by importing U.S. companies generally who act as the importer of record, and they file a customs entry. And you might want to look at the customs entry almost like a tax return that has all of the relevant information for customs to properly assess duties on that particular shipment. And so there's three general elements that are really important to determine what the duty rate is and the amount of tariffs that will be paid by the importer. The first is the Harmonized Tariff System Classification, or the HTS code. And this is a system that's comprised of over 10,000 different classification codes, and importers have to pretty much go through the code and figure out which code applies to their product by description. And it can be very detailed. So as I mentioned, there's over 10,000 codes, and similar items can have different codes and different rates of duty. So for example, in footwear, if you have a shoe with a leather sole, that might have a different classification and duty rate than a shoe with a rubber sole. For vehicles, light trucks and heavy trucks, different classifications, different duty rates. And in the chemical industry, a slight change in the molecular structure could change the classification code that's applicable and the potential duty rate. So that's the first, is the classification. The second is the country of origin, which is generally where the goods are manufactured or grown. There's this concept of a substantial transformation that must occur in a country for it to be considered a good of that country. So that's a really important concept during Trump's first administration, in that we saw many companies shifting some operations, not all their operations, but just enough to confer substantial transformation in, let's say, Vietnam to avoid paying duties on Chinese goods. So they might have some Chinese components in them, but if they substantially transform in Vietnam, they are no longer considered Chinese and not subject to the Chinese tariffs. So that's the second concept, country of origin, which is really important. And the third is the customs value of the goods. And there's a hierarchy of methods that can be applied. So there's five different methods. The most common is transaction value, which is really just the price actually paid or payable for the goods, the invoice price charged for the goods. But there's many additions that have to be included, and you can subtract some cost elements from that value. Because remember, we're talking about value, not price, right? So customs wants to make sure that the value for that goods is properly reflected. And if you're dealing with related parties, we can spend a whole hour determining whether a transaction is an arm's length from a customs perspective, because they have their own rules apart from the IRS.
That's really helpful background, Lou, and we could spend 10 hours on this topic, but we're probably going to try to keep it under an hour at least. All the listeners of this podcast have watched Schoolhouse Rock many times, so we all know where tax laws come from, but where do tariffs come from? It seems like all the action right now is coming from the White House, but what is the president's authority to impose tariffs, and what are the limitations to this authority?
That's a great question, because you would think that the executive branch has the authority to issue tariffs, but actually Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution grants the authority to levy tariffs and regulate international commerce to Congress. However, Congress has delegated some of this authority to the executive branch over the years, a lot of this happening during the Cold War era, in order to give the president a new negotiating tool. So this was done through various statutes, and there's particular limits and boundaries and requirements to invoke these statutes. So for example, there's Section 201 of the Trade Act of 1974, known as the Safeguard Tariff. And this is intended to really protect domestic industries from excessive imports of a particular product. So Trump used this in his first term to protect solar panels and large residential washers, where he imposed both tariffs and quotas on the importation of these goods from foreign countries. Another statute is Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962, also known as national security tariffs. And the president can invoke this whenever the import levels reach a certain level that threaten national security. And so President Trump used this in his first term to enact 10% tariffs on aluminum and 25% tariffs on steel products. And this was really done to allow the domestic manufacturing sector to grow in these areas. And then another statute is Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974, also referred to as unfair trade practices tariffs. And this is imposed on countries in response to some unfair trade practice that they're undertaking. During Trump's first term, he imposed 25% tariffs on over $350 billion worth of Chinese goods because China was allegedly infringing on IP rights. And so he used the Section 301 to carry out these extraordinary measures against China. Now, the statutory authority under which President Trump intends to impose the reciprocal tariffs, which he's mentioned, is really unclear because they don't fit neatly into any of the statutes I mentioned. Potentially the Section 301 statute under some notion of an unfair trade practice, because the idea behind the reciprocal tariff is that these countries are unfairly discriminating against the U.S. by charging higher tariff rates than the U.S. does for the same goods. And so in order to bring parity, he might invoke the Section 301 tariff to impose the reciprocal tariff. So for the new Mexico, Canada, and China tariffs, Trump invoked IEEPA to implement these tariffs. And this is the first time that that statute has ever been used to impose the tariffs. Now, he had threatened IEEPA under his previous administration against Mexico in response to the border crisis on the southern border. but he never actually implemented the tariffs because Mexico imposed the remain in Mexico policy for asylum seekers while the asylum process played out in the U.S. And that concession satisfied Trump, so he never actually imposed it. So this is really an extraordinary measure because it's the first time that IEEPA has been used to impose the tariff. Historically, IEEPA has been used to sanction bad actors. So think, for example, Iran because of nuclear proliferation or Russia because of the Ukraine crisis. But you haven't really seen IEEPA invoked to impose tariffs before.
Can we talk a little bit more about IEEPA? What does it stand for and what powers does it give the president?
IEEPA is the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. And under this act, if the president declares a national emergency, he has broad authority to enact further tariffs. In the case of the recent Mexico, Canada, and China tariffs, the national emergency that was cited was the border security and the influx of fentanyl crossing the Canadian and Mexican borders. China was roped in because a lot of the precursors for fentanyl allegedly come from China. So even though the national emergency was declared on the southern border, that was still used as the rationale to impose IEEPA tariffs on China.
So it sounds like the president can't unilaterally impose tariffs without some type of justification. Are tariffs subject to any congressional review? How does Congress figure into this process, if at all?
The tariff actions are not generally subject to congressional review, although there might be some reporting obligations depending on the different statutes. Again, depending on the statute, there are particular processes such as investigations and reports that have to be filed. And depending on which statute is invoked, this could generally take between 6 to 13 months. But the short answer is that Congress doesn't need to approve these unilateral actions by the president because the Congress has delegated this power over the years via statute. But with respect to the Chinese and the steel and aluminum tariffs, for example, this might not require a separate investigation because they could piggyback on existing tariff measures that were put into place during Trump's first administration that were kept in place by President Biden. And arguably, they're just adjusting the rates under the statutory modification authority. But any new action under Section 232 or 301 would require a new investigation, which again could take between 16 or 13 months. So, for example, if the president wanted to start a new 232 action on foreign automotives or European automobiles, he would have to start a new investigation, which could take some time. Now, under IEEPA, because it's a really extraordinary measure, as the name suggests, Emergency Economic Powers Act, there's no special processes that are required as long as the president declares a national emergency, which he did on day one on the southern border. So once declared, the president can take immediate action and the tariffs can remain in place as long as the national emergency is in place, and he can renew this on an annual basis. Now, Congress can always revoke the underlying national emergency declaration by joint resolution, but the president can veto that. And I see this unlikely given the current makeup of Congress. These IEEPA tariffs could remain for some time if the president chooses to.
Lou, is the lack of a special process for IEEPA maybe one of the reasons why President Trump is relying on it for the Canadian and Mexican tariffs?
I think so. I think he likes the unfettered executive power and also the immediacy of it, that he doesn't have to undertake an investigation. He could do it immediately, and he did that. So I think it suited his needs with respect to Mexico, Canada, and China to impose tariffs immediately or within his first 2 months at least.
And this might be the source of some frustration from Canada and Mexico, which would say that they're doing everything they can to prevent the fentanyl crossing the border. So it's really good background. How about judicial review? What legal challenges to tariffs could be raised in the courts?
Importers have lodged legal challenges against the president for his first term tariff actions under Section 301 and 232, for example, but they were generally unsuccessful, really showing the courts to be deferential to the broad trade authority that's been granted to the president under the respective statutes, and especially when it comes to national security matters. So IEEPA, for example, is such a national security authority. And even though it's never been used to impose tariffs before, there was a predecessor statute, the Trading with the Enemy Act, under which President Nixon imposed a 10% tariff on all imports in the U.S., and that action was challenged in the courts, and it was upheld by an appellate level court in the case of U.S. versus Yoshida. So if Trump's use of IEEPA were challenged, the courts would be reluctant to really second guess the political questions surrounding the National Emergency Declaration. But the courts did indicate in various cases in Yoshida that they will review whether the presidential means of execution bear a reasonable relation to the underlying national emergency confronted. In this case, it would be the border crisis, whether it makes sense to impose tariffs to stop immigration or fentanyl. And I'm hearing that lawyers are already gearing up to take up that challenge under IEEPA.
Thanks, Lou. So let's now talk about the specific issues related to tariffs proposed by the Trump administration. Trade between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico is largely integrated, so it's not uncommon for components to bounce back and forth between the three countries. How would the tariffs against Canada and Mexico impact this?
That's a big concern right now, especially for the automotive sector, because generally under Trump's announced tariffs with respect to Canada and Mexico, the tariffs would be expected to apply to the components each time they cross the border. And this could be very costly, for example, in the U.S. automotive manufacturers, because under NAFTA and the USMCA, for many years, these supply chains have become very integrated across the three countries. So parts, components, sub-assemblies cross borders several times before producing the finished vehicle, and tariffs will be assessed every time they cross a border. So these IEEPA tariffs on Canada and Mexico, as well as the global steel and aluminum tariffs that were announced, will likely increase the cost of goods significantly. And I think this is why we saw the markets drop after both announcements of tariffs against Mexico and Canada, and most recently after the pause was taken off. And so the question really is whether these costs are going to be passed on to consumers, or are they going to be borne by the importer or the manufacturer, or all of the above? It remains to be seen. But from what I'm hearing from many economists is that it will have some inflationary pressure. There might be disagreement on how much, but I think there's broad consensus that it will have inflationary pressure on the economy. In the first Trump administration, I'll point out that there were specific product exclusions granted to some importers. For example, if like a company can show that the only possible source of a particular component or part was from a foreign country, then the president granted exceptions for this. But so far, no such exemptions have been offered by the administrations. However, there was a slight reprieve for the automotive sector as tariffs on the industry have been paused temporarily through April 2nd. And in breaking news, as we were recording this, President Trump announced that goods from Mexico will also be exempt from the IEEPA tariffs as long as those goods qualify under the USMCA free trade agreement. President Claudia Sheinbaum was able to successfully negotiate a reprieve, and we'll see if Prime Minister Trudeau and Canada can get something similar maybe later today.
So, Lou, you mentioned the automotive industry, but are there other sectors in particular that may be influenced by the new tariffs?
The consumer and retail industry could be affected, especially for Chinese origin products. And they'll be affected because of the repeal of the Section 321 de minimis threshold on imports. So let me explain what that is really quick. Section 321 provides an exemption from duties for goods valued at $800 or less if imported by one person on one day. So it's a very limited exemption. But notably, a lot of Chinese digital retailers and online e-commerce platforms were able to benefit from this exception by selling directly and cheaply to consumers in the United States from abroad. So through express carriers, they would ship the goods and avoid the payment of duties on their product instead of bringing goods in on wholesale and storing them in the U.S. and paying tariffs on them. So they avoided paying duties on this. And many U.S. labor and trade groups in the U.S. really derisively refer to it as the backdoor free trade agreement with China. So there's really an effort right now to get rid of that de minimis exception. And there's a lot of bipartisan consensus and opposition to the provision. There are several bills in Congress right now to repeal de minimis for certain countries. So, for example, Russia and China being primary targets. And then there's other bills that really just want to lower the amount of the threshold to much lower than $800 for all countries. Just by way of background, it used to be $200 at one point, but it was raised a few years ago to $800. So companies are really monitoring these developments on the de minimis provision and considering alternative strategies to alter their delivery models and maybe diversifying their supply chain to get around having goods come from China.
So there are two types of taxes that seem to have drawn attention from the Trump administration, DSTs and VATs. So let's start first with DSTs. Can you explain what Trump is concerned about with these taxes and what action he's taken to address them?
Yeah, so on February 21st, Trump formally requested an investigation on countries with DSTs and other discriminatory foreign trade practices. Generally, I think Trump is upset with DSTs because he believes that in practice, they target U.S. companies that provide digital services. And during his first term, Trump had launched a Section 301, which is the unfair trade practices provision. He initiated a Section 301 investigation into the DSTs of numerous countries, including Canada, France, Austria, Italy, Spain, Turkey, and the UK. And as a consequence of the investigations, it was the Biden administration actually who announced tariffs against six countries in 2021. However, those tariffs were immediately suspended and were not ever implemented in order to allow Pillar One to be negotiated. But I guess now the question is that Pillar One, since it's at a standstill, the DSTs may make a return, and whether Trump is attempting to combat them with reciprocal action or Section 301 investigation, which may include some tariff action, remains to be seen. But it's very possible.
Sounds like the Trump administration's targeting of DSTs is consistent with the policy of the Biden administration and the first Trump term, and maybe isn't that surprising. But what about VATs? Has the U.S. expressed displeasure with VATs in the past? And what exactly does Trump dislike about them?
I don't think the U.S. has historically had a problem with the VAT, but President Trump does. And VATs are a consumption tax that are generally understood to be akin to the sales tax imposed by state and local governments. But in President Trump's February 13th executive order regarding reciprocal tariffs, Trump specifically called out VATs as another discriminatory trade practice. So it's definitely on his radar. And even though the VAT is a consumption tax, U.S. goods are subject to the VAT upon importation into the foreign country, while the companies exporting from that jurisdiction receive a VAT refund. And I think this has led Trump to consider VATs akin to a tariff because of that refund on the export side. And thus, Trump has stated that VAT rates on imports will be taken into account when calculating the reciprocal tariff on imports from those countries. So he's not just going to consider any disparity in tariff rates, but also potentially the VAT rate that a country imposes in order to determine what's the net discriminatory effect on the U.S. So it's interesting. And I think discriminatory characterization by Trump has frustrated many of our trading partners because VATs are destination-based tax that is levied equally on all transactions within a particular jurisdiction. Put differently, VAT regimes feature a border adjustment that ensures neutrality between imports and domestically produced goods so that the same VAT rate is charged on goods regardless of their origin, whether it's domestically or foreign produced.
So the VAT announcement is being met with hostility from our trading partners. How have other countries reacted to President Trump's tariffs, and how might they react going forward?
I'll start with China, and they're an expert in this because they went through the trade war during the first Trump administration, and they immediately implemented numerous measures, including 10 to 15% tariffs on energy exports, agricultural machinery, and U.S.-specified agricultural goods. They've also restricted the export of critical minerals and metals to the United States, and they've sanctioned and initiated investigations into U.S. companies operating in China. And they also filed a suit or a legal challenge with the World Trade Organization, which they did also during the first Trump administration. And they were successful to an extent. But honestly, I don't think the WTO serves as a guardrail on the Trump administration. So it's maybe more for show than anything else. Now, Canada has responded also with 25% tariffs on nearly $155 billion worth of U.S. imports, including alcohol, clothing, and household appliances. Mexico has not yet given the specifics of their retaliatory measures, but the president has indicated that there will be retaliatory measures potentially this weekend, so they should be announced soon. And the EU is bracing themselves for any tariff action and has already indicated that they will retaliate in kind, tit for tat, for any tariff measures that Trump imposes on European goods. Now, I think from the first term, many of these countries learned to be really strategic about their retaliatory measures, targeting specific products that are politically sensitive. So from districts that might be Republican that might have the president's ear and get him to shift his policy. So, for example, during the first administration, we saw tariffs on Kentucky bourbon and Levi jeans and Harley Davidson motorcycles, really targeted. And I think they learned that lesson. And so we'll continue to see targeted retaliatory measures from our trading partners. And countries have also learned to diversify their markets and where they're sourcing goods from. So we saw this particularly with respect to American soybeans, in that they diversified where they're purchasing those soybeans. And we're seeing more soybeans being purchased from Brazil and Central America, really hurting the American farmer. So these are all tactics that our trading partners are taking to really put a hurt where it counts on the United States economy.
Thanks, Lou. So we've heard that the proposed tariffs could generate significant revenue, with some estimates suggesting an increase of over $3.8 trillion over 10 years if implemented as proposed. Lou, do you have any thoughts on these revenue estimates and what they mean for tariff policy going forward?
The fact that President Trump is positioning tariffs as a significant revenue source and is promoting the creation of an external revenue service, or the ERS, suggests that tariffs might be a long-term fixture in his economic strategy. That's clear. The ERS could be viewed a bit of a branding exercise to lionize the collection of revenue from foreign countries and to draw a contrast with the internal revenue service, which taxes American families, right? ERS good, IRS bad. But nonetheless, if the ERS actually gets off the ground and established, this would be a significant development, that tariffs will be an enduring source of revenue. This wouldn't be done purely for branding purposes. And so today we know that tariffs aren't collected from foreign countries, but I have heard the suggestion that foreign exporters may have to pay a premium in the future to do business in the United States. And so that would be a fundamental shift in how tariffs work and could also contribute to the revenue calculation. I guess historically there was a period in time prior to the introduction of the federal income tax when tariffs were a major component of U.S. tax revenue. However, in the last 70 years, tariffs have consistently contributed less than 2% of total federal revenue. For instance, in 2024, U.S. Customs collected $77 billion in tariffs, making up 1.5% of the federal revenue. And that $77 billion includes all the special tariffs that Trump imposed. I know that the Committee for Responsible Federal Budget estimates that tariffs on China, Mexico, and Canada could bring in about $1.5 trillion over 10 years. But I would caution to rely on those estimates entirely, because the tariffs do have a tendency to influence taxpayer behavior, and it might undo some of the underlying assumptions to those projections.
One thing we've thought a lot about is, and we've talked on this podcast about potential changes to the tax code in 2025, 2026, the looming tax cliff. Obviously, these tariffs can't be taken into account for purposes of the reconciliation bill. And we will have an episode, I'm sure, coming up on that soon. But the reconciliation bill that will usher in the changes to the tax code will be, to some extent, debt funded. And the question is, how much of it will be debt funded? Revenue coming from tariffs, because that happens by presidential action and not by legislative action, wouldn't be taken into account for purposes of the scoring, but it could still be taken into account politically. That is, members might be more willing to debt fund $2.6 trillion to extend the TCJA tax cuts if they know there's another source of revenue and these tariffs could be that source. So that's something to keep in mind as well, in just the real impact of these tariffs. Before we close, in addition to tariffs, what else should we expect from the Trump administration on trade policy in the near future?
So I think we're going to continue to see a decoupling from China, and this could take the form of additional tariff measures and non-tariff measures as well. But just looking at tariff measures, for example, all of these tariffs that we've been talking about with respect to China are stacked. So let's say you have a widget that's made of aluminum, and that has an ordinary tariff rate of 5%. You would pay that 5% plus the 25% under Section 301 for China, plus the 25% on aluminum under Section 232, plus the 20% tariff under IEEPA. So it's very clear that these policies are designed to cause some pain on China and really to cause manufacturers to bring their manufacturing operations to the United States or elsewhere. More broadly speaking, I think April 1 is the deadline we're all looking to, because that's the deadline that the president has set for over 20 reviews that have been ordered under his American First trade policy memorandum. And I think we're likely to see additional action on reciprocal tariffs, unfair trade practices, and export controls. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw a Section 232, which is a national security action targeting foreign automotive sector. And we're also keeping a close eye on the Restoring Trade Fairness Act bill, which is currently in Congress, which seeks to revoke permanent normal trade relation or PNTR status for China. And if this happens, then the general duty rate, forget about the special rates that we've been talking about, a tariff, just the general duty rate would go up to 35% for Chinese goods. So in my example earlier, a 5%, the starting point would be 35%, and it would go up to 100% on strategic goods in the chemical, pharmaceutical, machinery, electrical equipment, and defense sectors. So again, this could be pretty significant with respect to China. Also on the horizon is the USMCA sunset review will take place in July of 2026, and we expect there to be a couple of sticking points with respect to market access for U.S. agricultural goods, particularly dairy with Canada. That's always been a bone of contention for the U.S. And also, I would imagine that there's going to be some attempt to increase the regional value content requirements for automotive goods, which is currently at 65 to 75%, depending on the particular part of component. But I think President Trump wants to see that higher, especially for the U.S. value content. So we'll probably see that. And I also expect additional measures to protect our national security via import restrictions, for example, on connected vehicles or drones that have Chinese or Russian inputs. We started to see a little bit of that under the Biden administration, but we're probably going to see more import restrictions under Trump, more of a muscular policy. And also probably see additional measures to protect America's technological edge via outbound investment restrictions and tightened export controls in key sectors, such as semiconductors, AI, advanced chips, quantum information technologies, defense, and aerospace. And so while tariffs might be grabbing the headlines as companies are concerned with the higher cost of imports, I think our exporting clients will also be grappling with retaliatory tariffs in a much more complex and restrictive export environment. So I think it's going to be a bumpy road going forward.
It's been a bumpy road so far, Lou, so I'm not surprised it's going to be a bumpy road going forward. But thank you, Lou, for your time today discussing this rapidly developing tariff landscape. And a special thanks to Michael Timmerman for his help behind the scenes with this episode. So while the long-term effects on taxpayers and the economy remain uncertain, it's evident that tariffs will continue to play a pivotal role in shaping global trade dynamics in the future. And as the House and Senate work to pass on identical budget resolutions for a reconciliation bill, we'll see whether tariffs impact the discussion regarding the deficit and revenue offsets. As always, please stay tuned for future episodes of KPMG's Inside International Tax to stay up to speed on the latest developments in U.S. international tax. Until our next episode, take care.